Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Great Integral Awakening. My name is Claire Zanet, and in addition to being one of the presenters in this series, I'm also on the board of Integral Enlightenment, the organization that's producing this event. It's great to have you with us for part 10 in our series featuring Terry Patton on Integral Life Practice. And before we begin, I want to take a moment just to thank all of you for your active participation in this dialogue, both on these live teleseminars and on our Facebook forum. We also want to thank our co-hosts at Integral Life, our 8 co-sponsors, for all of their support. For those of you who are listening for the first time, the way it's going to work is that Integral Enlightenment founder Craig Hamilton will introduce Terry and the day's topic. Then he and Terry will engage in dialogue for about an hour. And after that, we'll open it up for questions from the audience so you can interact with Terry directly. We're happy to announce we've upgraded our technology. This new conferencing service allows us to minimize volume discrepancies and provides us with a smoother Q&A process. When we get to the question and answer section, if you'd like to ask a question, just press star 2 to raise your hand, so to speak, and wait to be called on. And I think, Craig, you're going to go over these instructions again when we get to the Q&A section of the call.
Will do.
But before we dive into the conversation, I want to take a moment to briefly introduce you to our host, Integral Enlightenment founder, Craig Hamilton, who is the visionary behind this groundbreaking series. Craig is a contemporary mystic and pioneer in the emerging field of evolutionary spirituality. In his work at Integral Enlightenment, Craig integrates decades of intensive spiritual practice with insights gleaned during his 8 years as senior editor of the award-winning What is Enlightenment magazine. Through his writings and teachings, he is helping to articulate an authentic evolutionary mysticism and integral enlightenment, which illuminates the vital relationship between individual transformation and collective evolution. Craig is a founding member of Ken Wilber's Integral Institute and a participant in the Synthesis Dialogues, a 35-person interdisciplinary think tank presided over by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Craig lives and teaches in Berkeley, California, where he offers instruction and guidance in meditation and other aspects of evolutionary spiritual practice. And for anyone who's interested, he'll soon be offering a teleseminar series on integral enlightenment. So welcome, Craig, and I know I speak for all of us. I say how much we are looking forward to your dialogue with Terry.
Hey, thank you, Claire. And hello, everyone. Welcome back. I'm delighted to be here with Terry Patton, whom I've become quite good friends with over the past year since we met at the Integral Theory in Action Conference last August. In fact, Terry and I are now working together to expand the reach and the impact of Bay Area Integral here in the San Francisco Bay Area. So if you're in this area and you want to connect with us and get involved in local events, we've got a lot we're going to be cooking up over the coming months, so please connect with us. To let you know a little bit about Terry, he's a senior trainer with Ken Wilber's Integral Institute seminars, and he's the co-director of the team that's been developing Integral Institute coaching at Integral University. And he's worked with philosopher Ken Wilber and the core team at Integral Institute to develop Integral Life Practice, which distills essential dimensions of ancient and modern spiritual practices into an intelligent, contemporary, integral transformational lifestyle. And you may know him as a co-author of the latest book of his latest book, which he did with Ken Wilber, Marco Morelli, and Adam Leonard, which is Integral Life Practice: How to Design Your Own Training Program for Body, Mind, and Spirit. Terry's also a longtime student of the late American spiritual teacher Adida Samraj, and has also been a serial entrepreneur, starting and selling several successful small businesses. And he's also a grassroots conservationist involved in supporting wise stewardship and restorative redwood forestry. One of the things I really love about Terry is that he holds a rare combination of depth and breadth. He's a deep spiritual practitioner who speaks from decades of authentic, intensive spiritual practice. And he's also an extremely bright, broadly educated guy who can speak intelligently about pretty much everything, at least everything I've ever asked him about. So I'm really looking forward to seeing where we can go today with Terry. And I'd invite you to join me in welcoming Terry Patton to our forum. You can't hear the applause, Terry, but they're going wild out there. Thanks, Craig. Thanks for that gracious introduction. And thanks for creating this wonderful series. It's, I think, this free offering is unprecedented, and it really has offered a glimpse of this integral landscape to so many people, from some of the most articulate and insightful voices in the integral scene. You've already done a wonderful service.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. We're at, I guess, number 10 now. We've got four more to go, and now there's talk of potentially continuing the series in some form after. So it's definitely taken on a life of its own. I'm glad to have you here.
Well,
so just to tee us up a little bit for the talk today. So in this series, as you know, we're looking at how the spiritual path needs to evolve to keep up with our changing world and with the spiritual and evolutionary needs of contemporary seekers. And spiritual practice has always been at the heart of spiritual life, but most of the spiritual practices that we now have available to us were invented in a much earlier era when life was radically different than it is today and when human beings were radically different than we are today. So one of the big questions I've been asking, which was really at the heart of my own work in developing integral enlightenment and really the catalyst for this series, is what kinds of spiritual practices are best suited to us postmoderns and integralists? What kind of spiritual path really makes sense today? Is it a matter of simply updating our traditional paths with new clothing? Are we ready for a new kind of spirituality, some kind of hybrid? Along with Ken Wilber and others at Integral Institute, you've been involved in what I would feel is one of the most cutting-edge experiments in this area for many years now. And with the development of integral life practice, you've attempted to build a unique integration of ancient and contemporary wisdom and also ancient and contemporary transformative practices. So based on all of that work you've done, I think a great place to start would be for me to just ask you, what have you learned about what makes for an authentic, contemporary, transformative path? What are the essential ingredients you put together that make integral life practice a genuinely new and effective path to transformation?
Well, there are a number of different directions to approach that question from, and it might be helpful because not everyone on the call probably even knows what ILP is. Is to summarize that and maybe the history of how it's evolved, and then to answer your question more directly.
Great.
When we got together and began to teach integral life practice, we actually located ourselves in the tradition of Mike Murphy and George Leonard's integral transformative practice. We regarded what we were doing as a further evolution of the experiment they began. And their experiment essentially drew from the years of seminars at Esalen and the fact that everybody came down after their mind-blowing, life-changing experiences and was untransformed unless they lived a whole life of transformative practice. So the ITP form focused on a physical practice, which they called a kata, a community practice of staying current, and had a big emphasis on affirmation practices that focused on cultivating extraordinary abilities along the lines of some of the things that Mike talked about in his dialogue with you, the siddhis, the extraordinary capacities of the human body-mind that can be documented in scientific terms in contemporary times. That's what Mike's specialty is, but which are replete in the lore of the ancient traditions. People with extraordinary memory, people with extraordinary physical capacity, people with extraordinary meditative capacity. And when we looked at it, we felt we had a different interest, a different emphasis to our focus. We really were interested in the evolution of a higher consciousness that was, it wasn't really so much about extraordinary capacities, but of a higher responsibility, a capacity to meet this complex and challenging world more fully, in a way inspired by the implications of the often quoted line by Albert Einstein that the problems we face today can't be solved at the level of consciousness that
created them. What would it be for us to bring ourselves to a level of consciousness adequate to the amazingly fast changing and complexifying and I would say threatened and out of balance world that we're all living in? How can we participate in a way that's both fulfilling for us as individuals and effective in terms of making a positive contribution and helping humanity turn some important corners that we're facing? What would it be to do a practice that would have a relevance not just to our own growth, our own self-fulfillment, but to render us contributors to something bigger than ourselves? So our focus really was more on levels of consciousness, both in terms of waking up from the dream and in terms of participating in the dream in a more adequate way, understanding the relative world and participating in it in a way that, armed by an intuition of our freedom from the dream, but also fully willing to enter into the blood and guts and complexity and heartbreaking ambiguity of the challenges we face in everyday life. So the form that we forged initially focused on the personal practice, even though all of life is practice, if it's understood rightly. The whole matter of being alive is participating in what is often called the school of life, learning to play, you might even call it the game of life, to wake up out of the smaller games into the biggest frame of this larger game we're all involved in, like it or not. We wanted to give people something that was a little less philosophical and a little more concrete, and so we gave it a very discrete form, which had to do with practices, doing things in categories, which we called modules, so that we were cultivating that ongoing life of practice that you don't have to come down from. And most practitioners have some form of spiritual practice, some form of physical practice, some form of mental or intellectual inquiry, and not everyone does shadow work, but we all wish our friends did, don't we? and so those four categories, body, mind, spirit, and shadow, became the organizing principle for the, you might call it ILP 1.0, and we find that with a wonderful group of people, some of whom have already been on your series. Diane Hamilton and Genpo Roshi participated in the early Integral Life Practice seminars, and Hui Lam and Jeff Salzman played leadership roles with us, with Ken. And, of course, Ken was really the captain of the team. As we developed through a whole series of seminars an increasingly refined understanding of how to engage those modules of practice in a way that caught the essence of them, so that we were very consciously trying to bring the insights of modernity, scientific and psychological sophistication, together with the wisdom of the ancients, the ancient paths, in a way that was time efficient. A big part of the whole approach that we brought was to really see how the 80-20 rule applied, where with a relatively modest investment of time and energy could individuals maximize their growth. And one of the key principles that we noticed and we think we see validated again and again is that there's a kind of integral cross-training synergy. Somebody who just meditates but has no physical practice, no shadow practice, no intellectual practice, does not mature in a rounded and full way. Even their meditation practice doesn't proceed as deeply and in as comprehensive a way as it would if they were doing these other practices. There's a story Ken often likes to tell about a group of people who began a course of Vipassana meditation, and unknown to the Vipassana teachers, a group within that group began a weightlifting practice, and the weightlifters matured quicker in their Vipassana than the non-weightlifters. Now, weightlifting has nothing to do with Vipassana, but there's a synergy when we are breaking our unconscious patterns in one area of life. It liberates energy and attention in a way that affects all the other areas of life. So that's essentially the design that ILP had in its first incarnation. Now, in my work, in teaching ILP, I've come more and more and more not to so much emphasize these four modules as if they were the be-all and end-all. They're really the foundation for a life of self-transcending service. I think most people who come to the point where they would be even listening to this broadcast are just spontaneously wanting two things mainly. One is to self-actualize, to be all they can be without joining the army, to be more present, to be more aware, to be more caring and alive, to be more full and human and integrated and flexible and dynamic and, you know, to just fulfill the gift of this human life more fully. But also to go beyond that self-focus and to make a contribution to the world in a larger way. And I think that as you go along either of these paths, you begin to discover, as you know, so many people have, that you can't do one without the other, that my own self-actualization becomes empty if I'm not giving, that my attempt to save the world and save the whales and the planet and this and that is thwarted by the limits of my own development unless I'm growing all the time and making myself an instrument. And that's really the core of the integral insight, isn't it? That you know, the word integral means not leaving anything out.
Mm-hmm.
And the main thing we don't leave out is ourselves. We realize that we are implicated, that our study of anything is not merely objective, as if we were uninvolved, that our very observation is a practice that shapes the whole conversation, even affects what we're studying. And therefore, this sense of being implicated becomes richer and richer and richer. Now, with that having been said, you know, we've brought that together in the book, Integral Life Practice, which I continue to be really happy with. I think that it offers a view of the path that that any serious decades-long practitioner can consult and find new insights in and wholeheartedly give to their, you know, young friend or nephew or niece who's just entering the path and really feel confident that it offers a view of things that is balanced and deep and doesn't leave anything essential out. But beyond the book, what we find ourselves entering into is the awareness that really ILP is not an alternative to what people are already doing. It's a way of offering, orienting generalizations, insights, and clear, you know, key, clear, important distinctions about the nature of the whole matter of practice, such that you're already doing an integral life practice as well as you can, and armed with the insights and clarities that we've distilled in this particular formulation, you can simply do what you're already doing with more efficiency, more clarity, more wholeness. There are a lot of cul-de-sacs along the way, a lot of ancient errors, conflations, confusions. And I think we step through that in a way that that opens up the field and brings brings people together, too. I think it helps practitioners of a traditional path and atheists who are simply interested in peak performance and Christians and Buddhists and people who want to stand free of all traditions can all look at the orienting principles in ILP and see that there's a metta sangha that holds all these smaller sanghas, that we're all in a larger sense involved in a universal matter, and that the specifics of our paths are important, and it's not to reject them or throw them away, but to see the universal nature of the path is, I think, revelatory, and I think it also gives us a different level of company and cross-pollination that's important.
Beautiful. Really nice. And so I have a question. So essentially, you know, there's these four core modules, as you mentioned, within integral life practice: body, mind, spirit, and shadow. And then you said, you know, you're not entirely wedded to those as the frame, but they're just a foundational frame. And then you talked about these two essential impulses that most people are following onto whatever path they're on, which is the desire to be all that I can be, as you said, and to, you know, to contribute and be a part of helping improve our collective life, improve the world. And I'm curious, from all of your research and work and looking at this, is there, like, what line leads it all? Or to put it, like, what is the, because, like, is there, have you found that there's one particular piece of all of this that is sort of the linchpin around which everything else revolves? Or would you say that it's just different for each person, and for one person it might be their passion for the physical practice that leads and that drives everything else, and for another it's their passion for meditation and that kind of, or is there really an essential piece that almost comes first, or is the driving force for all the transformation that really makes, like, what's the key, the change that makes the difference? Is there something?
Well, that's a great question, Craig. Thank you. In different individuals, different clarities and passions lead. It is true that for some people, the physical practice leads. For others, it's meditation. You know, people have had a life-changing glimpse of divine reality that compels them to align the unillumined experience of quotidian life to that vision, and to restore their and return and maybe extend their experience of that profound unity. But as we grow over time, I think things change. I think to some degree that there are stage differences. At the beginning, you know, I recently was shocked and was laughing to see a survey that suggested that, you know, spiritual practices have become way more popular in recent times because of yoga. Yoga is now reaching millions and millions of Americans, and the reasons people take up a yoga practice were listed in percentage, and the single biggest reason was women took it up because they wanted this kind of shapely curve in their backside. They call the yoga butt. and you know, people can look at that and feel kind of horrified that this kind of narcissistic vanity is the reason people are doing yoga, and then dismiss the whole practice of yoga as if it's nothing but that.
Patanjali is rolling over in his grave.
I'm right. But I actually think that it's great. I think that people who are narcissistically involved, getting involved with yoga, some of them are going to discover that there's a deeper wisdom in that tradition, and they're going to actually be attracted to other things, and their initially narcissistic motives will naturally evolve. And that evolution of motives is one of the great things about practice. Whatever lower motive you may bring to practice initially, if you sincerely engage in that practice and, you know, hopefully are exposed to some wiser teachers or fellow practitioners, your own motives will begin to evolve too. And there's a great need for us to evolve, not just the top of the pyramid, the most aware people who are likely to be on this call, but people who are earlier in their development. So, you know, I think that's actually a good sign that we're beginning to draw more conventional people into forms of practice. Now, as you evolve, though, certain things begin to click into place. You begin to realize the futility of your egoity and the narcissistic motives that you've brought. You realize that they don't bring you real happiness. You begin to have a revulsion to your own constant narcissistic self-focus, and you outgrow these lower motives. And at that point, the self-focused motives that are usually that focus us in the typological differences in our personalities that make, for one person, a martial art becomes so compelling and enjoyable, for another person, meditation, for another person, intellectual reading, for another person, deep psychological work. After you begin to break through that self-focus, you're seized by that larger motivation, the sense that you articulated when you offered your turn in the Great Integral Awakening series about this way in which the world needs your practice, that your little decisions affect something larger. That kind of awareness begins to awaken in everyone. And so every single type of person who might have a more natural proclivity and strength in one area of practice gets drawn into a motive that requires them to participate on all levels. We can still be specialists. You know, we all have to have our unique expressions. There's nothing wrong with that. Practice isn't something that homogenizes us and makes us all the same. In fact, it liberates our uniqueness and our personality, our aliveness, our own. Everybody's a cartoon character, and the more awake they become, the more free they are to be that cartoon character in a Technicolor 3D, 100% uncorked, alive way that is, oddly enough, less and less egoic, even as it's more and more fully expressed. So I think that it does change, and the different foci, the different lines that lead people early on open into something different as practice matures.
Mm. Nice. And in terms of those four core modules, why those? So you've got body, mind, spirit, shadow. Tell me about how you ended up picking those four out of all of the potential groupings one could have come up with. And maybe also tell us a little bit about what you do within each of those four so we can all have a sense of what we're really talking about.
Okay. Well, it really had to do with the principle of this cross-training synergy.
Mm-hmm.
This is, to some degree, a rhetorical device. If we articulated, 23 core modules, this wouldn't be a very useful system. And the part of what Integral Life Practice is a way of offering a languaging of some key universals that make them usable and practical. These particular four core modules are really essential dimensions of most people's life. I think, Craig, that by the time you heard about ILP, because you had engaged in intensive sadhana with Andrew, you had been doing spiritual practices and intellectual study and development of your capacity to take perspectives, and you had been doing physical practices and maintaining fitness and flexibility and strength, and let the body mind be a healthy and functional vehicle, eating a reasonable diet and all the rest. You had been doing some shadow work, really going into the ways you hide from yourself. Those we focus on the four core modules because if you're doing practices in each of them, there's a certain basic balance and integration in your practice. And you might notice those are all personal practices. Now, as you develop and as you find sangha, you will do interpersonal practices where you'll be sharing and engaging in reflection and deep connection with others in relationship, and you'll be raising children, doing the yoga of an intimate relationship with your partner or spouse, making a contribution as an active involved citizen, all those kinds of relational practices are very important too. But the four core modules refer to the individual practices that we do to render the vehicle, the body-mind, clear and available to make its contributions in relationship. So it's best to understand them that way. And you know, if you like, I could review a few of the key orienting things that describe each of those four core modules.
I think it would be helpful, yeah.
Well, in the body module, we make a point of illuminating the fact that we have three bodies. The physical body that we always usually think of when we use the word body is only one dimension of our incarnation, that there are dimensions of the being subtler than the physical that are also important. The seven chakras refer to seven levels of subtler energies, and many practices in yoga and qigong, tai chi, and other traditions are energetic practices that focus on the subtle body, and it's important to include that in our view of what body practice is. And there's even what's sometimes called the extremely subtle body in the Tibetan traditions, or the causal body, which is generally viewed as being absolutely still and without content, either infinitesimally small or infinitely vast, black, unmoving. It's essentially the body of the witness, the body of consciousness itself. And we usually invoke that as a... make sure to include that so that the body is framed in its most expansive and profound contexts, and the exercise of the body is conscious.
So you're, now, when you talk about physical exercise here, your body, the body module, you're not simply saying, you know, take up some exercise, go lift weights, and now you're doing the body practice. But you're saying if you're doing the body practice within the integral life practice frame, you're doing it as an extremely conscious practice that has to do with more than just your physical. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And an understanding of the full dimensionality of the body-mind,
mm-hmm.
that
nice.
it's both a physical and an energetic phenomenon. And we offer a bunch of important orienting generalizations. For instance, within the physical, exercise is only one part of it. Diet, sleep are equally important. We also talk about the gross physical exercises having certain key categories that it's important to remember. You know, they each matter. It's not like every practitioner will do exercises in all these categories every day or week or month, but if your understanding of physical exercise includes strength training, cardiovascular fitness, and neuromuscular coordination, the kind of thing you get from split-second coordination in a sport, you know, basketball or dancing or surfing, remember, yeah, that's right. If I just build muscle strength, I'm going to gain a lot, but I won't gain some things I would gain if I did sustained cardiovascular exercise, and that offers some different benefits. And if I just do strength and cardio and I don't do anything that improves my coordination and the way that my brain and body are interacting and my split-second timing, my aliveness in those dimensions, something could be left out. And just having that awareness that all those things matter, those kinds of orienting generalizations are one of the main things that we offer with ILP.
Hmm.
Another thing that ought to be brought up is that we also have a concept, we call it one-minute modules, such that in our busy lives, sometimes people only have, you know, some days 10 minutes to devote to practice. And we take the attitude that if you spend real intentional time for that 10 minutes connecting to and invoking your practice relationship to each of these modules, your day is going to be profoundly different than than otherwise. But that 10 minutes can be used very, very wisely for a very high leverage purpose. So we offer forms of practice that only take a few minutes in each module. And in the body module, we have a particularly, I think it's a evocative and poetic form. We call the one-minute module for the three-body workout that invokes those three bodies and exercises them in a basic way. And so in a way, it's important to look at practice as something that naturally evolves across the course of your life, that you need to make enduring commitments to a series of practices, but that over time you can change them. So your physical practices in the summer when you can go outside and, you know, perhaps you have some sports that are something you love and enjoy doing and are part of your life, maybe they need to change during the winter. And those kinds of natural rhythms and the breathings and shiftings of the body-mind, it's part of how we keep practice fresh. So it's important to make a commitment and fulfill it, but it's also important to periodically shift it and for it to ebb and flow and move as we move and change across the life cycle. Now, that body practice, of course, is just one of the core modules. The mind practice is equally important. In our first expressions of integral life practice, we mainly taught people aqua theory, Ken's wonderful integral orienting generalizations really are psychoactive and help wake up new clarities and capacities to more adequately interpret our experience.
And just for people who don't know, the aqua theory, you're referring to Ken Wilber's four quadrant, all quadrants, all levels, all lines, kind of his basic integral theory, and you were
That's teaching, right. That
theory. And
that's right.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make... But it's important for people to understand that the mind module is really all about taking perspectives, taking more adequate perspectives. And aqua theory can help us take more adequate perspectives in many ways, but it's not the only way our capacity to take perspectives can be exercised. And in fact, the practice of taking perspectives is not just one of being able to take more complex or nuanced perspectives, but also being able to shift flexibly, context-specific shifts of perspective. You know, if a truck is bearing down on you, you don't want to be making complex meaning. You want to be making very simple and clear distinctions and acting on them.
Run!
Exactly. That's the most adequate way to make meaning. If you're all plugged into integral theory and trying to see the implications of all kinds of, you know, dimensions to things, it can inhibit your flexibility if you're doing that inappropriately.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the real combination of yourself with aqua theory renders you more capable of being very simple and ordinary and not terribly philosophical or sophisticated when that's called for.
Gotcha. Okay, and I'm... Because we have limited time, and I really want to get into the spiritual part, and we did a big piece with Diane on shadow recently, and I know she's worked a lot with this. I want to just kind of shift you into the spirit module. And particularly, one of the themes that's emerged over and over throughout this series is Ken Wilber's notion that there are three faces of God or three faces of spirit. And in my dialogue with Ken, we didn't get to speak about this in as much depth as we had wanted to because we got onto other things and ran out of time. And I know this is a big part of your own work and your own emphasis, and I'd love to drill a bit deeper into these three areas, what they really mean and what it means to be engaged in all three faces of spirit and why that's so important. So could you maybe give a little overview of that and sort of take us into the three faces of spirit as a kind of core integral practice?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Craig. Yeah, that feels right. Well, the first thing that needs to be said is that we don't know anything in relation to spirit. Spirit is that which is unknowable. Spirit is the mystery of existence, the profundity that exceeds our conceptual mind, our meaning making, our words. It is when the hair stands on end all over the body that we're in the presence of what we recognize to be spirit. It's when we're astounded. It's when we're taken beyond our mere perspectives that we're aware of that which is, you know, just capital T, that. And we have words, God, spirit, the mystery, and they seem to, you know, they make a noun, they reify this vast mystery. But existence itself is a miracle, a mystery. It's beyond any perspective we can take on it. So it's so essential that we realize that the nature of spirit and of real spiritual practice is something that breaks us beyond all perspectives. You know, that said, we are meaning-making machines, us human beings, and we apprehend things through the fundamental perspectives that are embedded in human language, first, second, and third person perspectives. And so the ways that we approach the mystery of being tend to fall into these three categories of first, second, and third person. And, you know, it may be useful to think a little less abstractly and a little more concretely about how that shows up in people's lives. Third-person spirituality is something we most often encounter. Well, any time that we are contemplating the mystery of existence as if it were an object of our attention, where we are contemplating it in the third person, that's third-person spirituality. The most common and universal way that people engage in third-person spirituality is communing with nature, looking upon the body of spirit. It's as though God has a body that looks like a blue sky with clouds and rays of sunshine and changes in light and birds swooping and trees growing and the sounds of nature and all the rest. And that sense of contemplating the body of spirit is the most universal and essential form of third-person spirituality that is primarily sensate. We also do third-person spirituality in a more intuitive way, and that's what we're doing right now, where we essentially do philosophy, where we look at the patterns that connect our experience, and we see the hidden structures of things, and it brings us into contact with the hidden forms and patterns of reality, such that intuitively we are looking upon it, the body of spirit. And this is what people have done historically through all theology and philosophy, and even the origins of science were undertaken in this spirit by many of the very religious early philosophers and scientists of the Enlightenment.
So let me just jump in, because I've been wanting to get a deeper understanding myself of this, of the specific distinctions between these three aspects. So if I'm having an experience of catalyzed by whatever means, whether it's by practice or a conversation we've had about higher things or a moment in nature or a sunset, but if I'm having an experience of just awe, kind of overwhelming awe and just amazement and depth, just but in the face of the mystery of existence and this profound kind of the glory and mystery of what is and this extraordinary divine reality that we're partaking in, that's third person. That's the third face of spirit.
Well, it is if you are contemplating it. If you are a subject and your contemplation is object,
yeah.
to your experience,
right.
Then
right.
And it is exactly as you described it. That's third person spirituality.
Right. As distinct from, say, first person, which many of us are familiar with, this kind of I am that experience.
That's right.
Where I'm aware of my divinity. Say a little more about that, because of course some people who are on the theistic side will always say, "Oh, that's a kind of terrifying narcissism, spiritual narcissism." But obviously, it's much deeper than that, and many traditions hold that as the ultimate realization. So take
well,
us into that.
First-person spirituality has really been critical to the resurgence of spirituality in recent years. This whole conversation is being had because all the world's traditions became available to us at one time, and we could, and people, mainly Westerners, took up Eastern paths and then had a generation of experience with them. And out of that, we could begin to compare our experience. And it was our discovery that the space in which experience arises, the consciousness that is the witness of the witness, the most radical, you know, bare bones screen on which all our mental, physical, visual, auditory, kinesthetic, olfactory experience is projected, that one is more truly who we are than any of the content, than any of the emotions and impulses and ideas and the things we identify with, that the bare experiencer is more me than any of the rest. And in deep meditation, I arrive more profoundly in that bare consciousness until people can have that radical experience in which they really know themselves not to be separate from anything.
Right.
And they stand in that subjective source of all experience as the very capital S self of all. And that non-dual realization, that awareness arrived at that way, has been the key breakthrough. And it's been done through first-person spiritual practices. First-person spiritual practices have been the most permeable ways for people to break through to an aperspectival, radical experience in which observer and observed are not different. So it's very, very important to respect and honor first-person spirituality. It has been the form of spiritual practice through Buddhist, Hindu, and then many of the current popular teachers like Eckhart Tolle or Byron Katie are expressions of primarily first-person approaches to spirituality. And all of them in their fulfillment break beyond the limits of a first-person fixation. You see, we're rational people. You know, our creation myth is the Big Bang. We were probably kids, you know, much too young to understand what it meant when we were first exposed to the equation E equals mc squared. But E equals mc squared means that all there is light. It means that all this matter is a bunch of incredibly concentrated, petrified light, that this whole universe, vast beyond imagining, is nothing but light. That is very easy to resolve with an intuitive, meditative experience of non-separation from all things, of being the subjective, non-separate experiencer who is not divided from experience. So first-person spirituality and the non-dual understanding of things has been, I think, the key passage for us to understand all our forms of spirituality in a more radical and adequate transrational context. And I'm a, you know, as you can obviously tell, an enthusiastic appreciator of first-person spirituality. But actually, what I'm most excited about is second-person spirituality.
And yeah, so say more about that, because here we are in a time when, you know, the notion of second-person divinity or spirituality just conjures up for us, okay, you want me to believe in God above, you want me to believe in a guy on a throne who, or someone who died on a cross for my sins, and I'm going to have a personal relationship with God, and no thank you, I left all that behind. I prefer this first-person brand much more, and that's really the place where I think many of us are sitting at this point, is anything to do with thinking God as a you, as an other. Well, for one thing, everybody would say, well, that's dualistic. You're making God outside, putting God outside yourself. When haven't you had the big enlightenment experience that, you know, you are consciousness? So I'd love it if you could, yeah, push into why this is so important to resurrect the second person divine in an authentic way.
Yeah, thank you. Well, once you've had that recognition of the non-separation of everything, that non-dual context, once there's some intuition, even just a basic brightening, an illuminated, intuitive sense about this non-separate condition, one can approach this whole matter of an intimacy with God, a relationship with God, in a whole different way. There's just a profound shift. Instead of having to believe in a God, you can be released and know that God is mystery, that the one who I would be having a relationship with is the one I must have always already been in relationship with, that the frame out of which I've been living, the existential stance in which I've been experiencing my life, may have been one in which I am imagining I am alone in a dead world, in a world of its, in an I-it dynamic with my very existence. And recognize that existence itself, this vast, amazing, chaotic multiplicity of beautiful, cruel, heartbreaking, amazing, confounding, poetic, exquisite, gorgeous experience is also coherent, that it has soul qualities, that it's not just dead, that it is conscious and it is alive, and that all of it together is somehow conscious in relation to me. I've never been alone. I've lived the drama as if I was alone, but I never was alone. That I've been witnessed even in my most private moments, that there's never been a radical separation, and that I've been intimately connected with otherness in every moment of my experiencing. I was born out of intimacy. I will die back into the arms of the beloved, the other, that there really is an intimate there. And that one does not have to be conceived to be a coherent personality who is having an attitude or experience toward me in the ways that we might conventionally have conceived of a mythic God to have. That we can recognize something about the whole nature of our existential way of being, the way in which the heart can radically open into a connectedness in which we're no longer living this drama as if we are alone in it, and in which we can come into an I-you relationship and an I-thou relationship with moment-to-moment experience in which the it's as if we've been averting our gaze from the conscious, divine, profound, mysterious other, and we begin to dare to notice that we aren't alone and never have been alone. That the eyes that look back at us, they look back with infinite love and compassion, but also in a way that looks right through our act and our games and our self-presentation. That we're connected with an otherness that is wise and profound and has a kind of forgiveness, but also a gravitas and a seriousness. That demands authenticity and greatness and sees our uniqueness and our beauty and our cravenness and our turning away, our contraction, but also our potential, you know, with unblinking fullness. And as we can recognize that this relationship is not with someone I can fully conceive. This is, you know, this language I'm using, it's poetic, but it's intimacy with mystery itself. It's relationship with mystery itself. The non-dual ground for a second person relationship transforms it, and it isn't really a return to the old mythic intimacy or the old mythic way of praying. It's a graduation into something that is, I think, the cutting edge for most contemporary spiritual practitioners. It's the way that we mature in our third and first person spirituality even more.
You know, one good reason why that's probably true is that within a purely first person spiritual practice where essentially what I'm realizing is my own divine subjectivity, where I'm really realizing I'm one with all, I'm not separate from this whole event, there's kind of, I don't know how to put it, there's nothing bigger than you in that context.
Yeah.
You're the biggest thing there is. And while in its kind of pure form, like in what we might call a pure realization, perfectly embodied, that would do away with ego, because obviously there's no small you either. There's just the infinite that should theoretically consume your ego or take you beyond it. I think in practice, in most cases, what tends to happen is the ego doesn't get challenged so much by that realization. It might get put in perspective, ideally, but I think often for people it even ends up inflating the ego to a certain degree and puts the person at ease in a certain way, where probably most of us could use a certain amount of second person divine, where there's a sense of someone, and I kind of mean it metaphorically, but someone bigger than me that I'm humble before, that I have to answer to in a sense, that starts to maybe keep me on my knees in some kind of humility before and awe before the greatness of that I think has maybe more potential for kind of ego reduction and ego containment and driving a kind of effort towards self-purification that might not even seem necessary within a purely first-person path, but obviously really is.
Right on. So, beautiful, Craig.
Yeah.
It also opens the door for us to be related to one another and to teachers or coaches in a whole different way, in which we are together in relation to this mystery that demands something of all of us. And we can presume a kind of access. You know, the core of that relationship to otherness is one in which we, I like to notice the correspondences with the old mythic forms, but kind of resurrect them in a new transrational way.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a kind of a new higher understanding of repentance, a recognition that this separation, this egoity, this contraction is something that is happening at a very profound level, probably on that causal level that we were talking about earlier. Maybe I don't even know, you know, it's like a muscle that's hard to find, but I'm doing it. My separation is not something done to me. I'm not a victim of my experience of separation. I am on a very deep level that's hard to access. I'm doing it. I'm creating it. And I wish I wasn't. And how could I not? And what is it I can do now that can open me into a more authentic, real, conscious, alive, present condition? How can I wake up now and be true now? How can I do that? That yearning, that's repentance.
Mm-hmm.
And in repentance, something opens up, and we can rediscover contact, communion, grace. We can be in touch then with, that's what salvation is, you know, in the old language. And that connectedness and the enacting of that connectedness is at the core of the intimate interior experience. But what does that open in terms of our way of relating to one another as fellow practitioners?
Right.
You know, if I am repenting, I can speak intimately to you about the way that repentance needs to show up for you to meet this moment more authentically. I can make a demand on you. I can.
Right.
I don't make that demand from a righteous place. I make that demand from the most humble place, because I'm continually, not just on my knees, but you might say constantly getting down onto them.
Hmm.
You know, constantly getting off the egoic mode is it's in the getting, you know, turning my head away from the way I've averted my gaze from the beloved. And that never ends, right?
You know?
The thing I remember that I try to reenact is the thing, you know, the ego then wants to feel connected, and I'm trying to have that feeling, and it's no longer the authentic thing anymore, right? I have to rediscover what is it in this moment authentically to turn. And that engagement, you know, I think that this is a way that we can expand and deepen and enliven our first-person spirituality. Second-person spirituality is not an alternative.
Right.
It's a deepening, and it is when we are really doing second-person and first-person and third-person spiritual practice that we are ever more drawn beyond the limiting points of view that each of them may tend to connote, drawn into a mysterious apprehension of reality in which the very force of reality can find its conduit through the core of our own being and find expression in the world through and as us, in which we're not doing first-person, second-person, or third-person spirituality. We're informed by all of them and surrendered beyond all of them to the ineffable, mysterious, unknowable, awesome, wild, astounding, divine reality that is always the case and is us, but is, in a sense, devouring us, you know, to the degree that we yield to let ourselves be used by that one. All our corners are tumbled off us, you know, and we're continually, you know, brought to our knees.
Oh, that's beautiful, Terry. Wow. Thank you. It's great. I really would love to go even deeper right into where we're going, but there's one more thing I want to cover with you before we go to the questions. So I'm going to extend this part just by another 5 minutes to really get into this last piece. You brought up, you know, how we relate to our teachers and our coaches, and one of the things I wanted to just go into a little bit is, you see, like you were just speaking beautifully about that second person relationship with spirit, and I know, you know, for both you and I, we're people who submitted ourselves to a really, in many ways, very traditional guru disciple relationship for, you know, in my case, 13 years. In your case, I think it was what, 15 or 17 years?
Yeah, 15.
Something like that. And you know, we're in this time where the whole notion of spiritual authority is kind of the 300-pound gorilla in the room. You know, traditionally, it was always assumed that one needed a guru or a spiritual master to guide one along the path. Yet now, most of us postmoderns have a deep resistance to accepting any kind of authority, and particularly spiritual authority. And there's obviously a lot of reason for that, because many contemporary teachers have fallen into scandal or been shown to have feet of clay to a certain degree, so there's a lot of skepticism. And at the same time, without that higher guidance, it seems almost impossible to navigate this most subtle territory of authentic realization. So you, like myself, you're someone who's attempting to pioneer new forms of spiritual mentorship that are outside of that traditional guru-disciple model, but that still ideally capture many of the needed elements for people who really need guidance but are not ready to go, you know, join the ashram, so to speak, and first probably for some good reasons and some, you know, egoic reasons. But nonetheless, I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about what you've done with pioneering this new approach to mentorship in the form of integral coaching, and your experience of working with clients within this new framework, and how does it all fit together in your perspective?
Thank you. Well, let me make a kind of a series of comments. First of all, I think we're in a very difficult time because even though the era of the great guru and the freedom to submit, you know, has passed, and for very good reasons, we've seen the limits of uncritical submission to a spiritual authority. We lost something when we lost our ability to enter uncritically into that kind of submission. By really trusting a guru and giving over our choice and simply conforming ourselves to a will outside our own, many of us have been transformed so profoundly and so usefully. And I don't see people much interested in that in the same way lately. Mm-hmm. It's the whole climate has become so profoundly anti-guru and anti-spiritual authority that it doesn't seem possible quite in the same way. But it's only through awakened transmission that the path has even been created, and it's only been through submission to something beyond ourselves that we've ever been awakened. Now, I also, though, think that in the postmodern postmodern eras, we can no longer simply use the old forms. All the guru, master, roshi, lama forms of relationship evolved during traditional times, mostly anciently, and they addressed simpler people, simpler social dynamics. We can't just have a relationship like that because there are going to be too many places of cognitive dissonance. I don't care how cool your teacher is. There's going to be something or other where they have a blind spot. They're, even as utterly illumined, even though they may show up as God in a way that's transmissive and amazing, and there may be remarkable awakened beings of, you know, deserving the most respect, they're not going to be able to hold every single aspect of your diverse, fast-changing experience. That's just not possible anymore. So I think that people who enter into a guru-disciple relationship might be well-served if they could have a relationship with somebody that has a very different set of presumptions, a professional relationship where there's no granting of your own authority to that other person, where they provide a professional service for a fee with clear agreements and a set of ethical guidelines that govern the way that's done. And I've become interested in working with people as a coach in just this way because I think that we needed a new pedagogical role, that what was developing was an era in which people needed a whole team, in a way, of helpers at different times along the path. A therapist, perhaps a guru, at least a yoga teacher or a martial arts teacher, maybe a personal trainer. A variety of people might play roles, large or small, in helping people grow. And a coach who had some depth of realization and authenticity of practice, who could specifically help us in the evolutionary matter of growing to higher levels of consciousness, that was a role that hadn't actually been identified quite. And yet I think that the profession of coaching, which helps people with a whole variety of things, not all of which involve development to higher levels of consciousness, but that it's in that role as coach that I can serve people in a new way and pioneer a new role that I think is necessary, not in order to get rid of the old spiritual authority role, but in a way to make it safe to engage it.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Nice. And so in your work with people, what do you find is the, like, in a sense, can the coach for certain people replace the guru, or do you still feel that there's a critical role for both?
I think that in some lives, some people are destined to a radical commitment to awakening that involves having to jump off the holy jumping off place and surrender themselves in submission. And I think that everybody I know, I'm in my late 50s now, and I got onto the path in a pretty intense way when I was still in my teens. So over those years, I've known a lot of people who've done decades of practice in different schools. It's been my experience that the people who found a teacher and submitted to that teacher ended up with some recovery that they had to do later. They got confused. They got trips laid on them. They had their boundaries violated. But they grew, and they were transformed. And the people who went into paths that were, you might say, clean, where the boundaries were never violated, really polished the form of their way of being in beautiful ways in many cases. But I don't think that the core of their egoity got challenged as deeply and that the profound transformation was possible. So I tend to be one of those who would validate and champion that there is a space for that guru relationship and that it's necessary in some lives. However, it's undeniable that it's not going to happen in most people's lives. Most people have so many antibodies, and there's almost a consensus in the contemporary spiritual conversation that gurus and guruism is a something we're leaving behind. And you have to feel really, really right about it before you do it. So in most cases, people won't have a guru. And I'm interested in what we can do when we have less authority. Sally Kempton said some wonderful things about how the less submission, the lack of submission or the limits on submission that tend to apply these days present some interesting opportunities and possibilities, but also constraints. And I think we need to pioneer ways that people can get past their own blind spots. After all, if you're steering the ship of your own spiritual practice, the person with the least insight into your blind spots is always in charge.
Right. So, big problem.
You really need something else in the mix. It's gotta come in. And a coach can provide a lot of that, but of course only to the degree that you give the coach, that you decide to engage, to respect and honor and let yourself be penetrated by that coach and let yourself go beyond what you can see for yourself. So I'm answering the question in a little bit of an evasive way, in the sense that in some lives I think the guru or some real serious.
Uh-oh.
No.
You're there.
Yeah, I'm not sure what happened.
I don't know, but you're here and I'm here, so hopefully
good.
We're all here.
Well, I think in some lives that kind of submission is going to be necessary, and we shouldn't shrink from saying that. And yet, in most cases, that's not going to be the form that people's lives are taking. And I'm interested to serve them where they are.
Right. Great, Terry. Well, that's really illuminating. And I would love to go into it more because this is something I'm really interested in too. But I feel I have hogged you to myself for too long. By the way, are you good to go a bit long just so we can still have a half an hour of Q&A, or do you have a
stop? Yeah, I'm happy to do that.
You're great. Okay, good, because we're flexible. Fortunately, this isn't radio and we don't have another show, so to speak, after. So, good. So we are now going to move on to the question and answer part. If you have a question for Terry Patton, simply send us your question via instant message in the teleseminar window on your computer or dial into the conference line number. And we now have new technology, so you don't have to wait until I ask for a question from your region of the world. You can just press *2 on the phone, and that will raise your hand on my screen, and then I can call on you directly and unmute you. So you can call in and press *2 or send us a message. Before we take your questions, though, I just want to mention a few of our partners and sponsors. First, I want to tell you a bit about the two organizations hosting this event. If you haven't yet visited integralenlightenment.com, I'd invite you to go there today and download our free guided meditation, Opening to the Great Perfection, which also includes a guided contemplation to help prepare for meditation, which is part of the new kind of innovation and practice that we're pioneering at Integral Enlightenment. You'll also find a collection of free audios, articles, and videos exploring what it means to live an authentic spiritual life in today's world. And if you're enjoying today's event, you will love Integral Life, featuring over 150 hours of audio and video discussions with today's great thinkers, leaders, visionaries, and artists, mostly moderated by Ken Wilber. They're making a special offer to all participants in the Great Integral Awakening. If you sign up for premium membership, you get your first month free. Also, you receive a DVD and two CD set with all their content from 1 month shipped to you for free. Just go to startyourintegrallife.com. That's startyourintegrallife.com. And a few of our partners, I want to encourage you to check out Now and Zen, makers of Zen clocks and meditation timers. Zen clocks feature natural acoustic chimes and gongs which wake you gracefully and naturally, and also serve as aesthetically sophisticated timers for your integral life practice or other spiritual practice you're doing. And all of these have been invented by philosopher Steve McIntosh. You can see their extensive line at now-zen.com. That's now-zen.com. Also, the new Feminine Power is excited to offer you a free audio download of their 75-minute online seminar, Awakening the New Feminine Power, How to Become Your Authentic Self and Co-Create the Future of Our World, featuring Claire Zammit and Catherine Woodward Thomas. To access this free download and learn about an integral spiritual path developed by women for women, visit femininepower.com. That's femininepower.com. Okay, we are now going to open this up for questions. If you have a question for Terry, send us an instant message in the teleseminar window or dial the conference line number and press star 2 to let us know you have a question, and then just wait until I call out your name and you'll be on the line. So here we go. I just have to switch screens for a sec, and we will first take an instant message question. Let's see. This is from Kevin in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. The three-person approach in integral life practice sounds very much like the Christian Trinity: God the Father, or I amness; God the Son, thou artness; and God the Spirit, it isness, which calls for a personal relationship in, with, and for each person. How does the ILP three-person approach to spirituality compare to this? Does it involve a personal relationship only from the second-person perspective? Interesting question. Do you get the gist?
Yeah, I think I do.
But he's saying that you have a in the Christian Trinity, you have a personal relationship with the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, and so he's asking if that's the same in your way of approaching it.
This actually opens up an interesting kind of side conversation that I think I'd like to respond to, which is that there are two different streams in integral spirituality, one of which has to do with integral approaches to, like, staying with the traditional conversation as it has been developing and informing it more and more with integral perspectives. And the other is to encounter spirituality in a liberated form that isn't really making much of a reference to the traditional conversation, and finding out what the truth is in a kind of completely clear postmodern world space in which, you know, it's, say, a post metaphysical spirituality, and then to see ways that the traditional language corresponds to what we're encountering in that free space. The conversation I just had is of the latter kind, but the question kind of asks about what we might do in the former kind of frame. And that isn't really the thrust of my work. I find that if we have a conversation about integral Christianity that is referencing the theologies and the Gospels and what Jesus said about this and that too closely, it's for me, it can draw us into all kinds of conversations that end up not necessarily giving me the same immediate, vital, alive connection to radical spirit, you know, directly. But this is a super important thing for many to do. It isn't my dharma, but it is a valid dharma, and it's one that I really honor and respect. In the case of this question about Trinity, I can answer that a little more directly and say, inevitably, everything we do that's spiritual is penetrating the very core of our being. You know, authentic spiritual experience is so moving and alive, and it is absolutely personal. You cannot have an experience of I am-ness that isn't as personal an experience as you've ever had in your life. The most radical samadhis, even if they end up giving you an impersonal realization, they represent the discovery of that impersonality at the very depths of your own person. And you bring everything that is personal to the mix. And that said, I think there's something special about the personal relationship in second person. It's in second person that I can feel that I personally have a love relationship, that I am loved and forgiven and blessed by divine reality, me personally, and that I personally can make the gestures of self-transcending practice and service and repentance of my own contraction and egoity that get me right with God in a very personal way. So I think that although it's all personal, there is a kind of dimension to the personal relationship in second person that is different, that I am waking out of the story into radical experience of consciousness itself, which we might call Christ consciousness in first person spirituality, that I am I'm having an experience that is inherently less personal in second and rather in first and third than I am in second person forms. So I would agree with everything that the questioner said, that there's something personal in all three forms. But I also would question whether this correspondence of the Trinity to the three faces of God is, it's not lacking in validity, but it is, as my teacher used to sometimes say, it's true enough to be said, and there's a lot to be learned from saying it and looking into it. But let's not hold it too tightly. We can hold those correspondences loosely and let them go and decide that, in a way, the three faces of spirit stands in its own world space, completely independent of the Trinity, and that we can get all kinds of richness from the Trinity conversation and all kinds of richness from the three faces and not necessarily need to make them add up.
Great. Well, thanks, Terry. That's really great. And thanks for your question as well. So we're going to now try and try out our new technology and see how it works. So I'm going to take a question from Neil Duncan in Smithtown, New York. And let's see if it worked. Neil, you should be online. Are you there, Neil, with your question?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, great. Hi, Craig and Terry. I am a practitioner of evolutionary enlightenment. And in that particular practice, there is a, an individual practice in terms of what you're doing, meditation and following certain principles. And then there's a collective practice that is about the emergence of a new consciousness. And I'm wondering, Terry, if you could speak a little bit about what the collective practices might be in the integral world.
This is one of the cutting edges of integral spirituality, and I think Enlightened Next is one of the important pioneers of that work. So I have a lot of respect and appreciation for the attempt that you're all in, the experiment, you might say, the courageous going for it that you all are involved with. Collective practice, though, begins in very personal ways. The first forms of collective practice are your relationships with other people. It's your relationships with friends and partners and child rearing. If you have a service role as a healthcare practitioner or a teacher or even anybody in business with all your multiple relationships, the way you relate to others is a field of practice. So all of that is inherently practice. And I think that we're increasingly aware that as most people went through a period of of time of having some political consciousness being raised, and then came to feel that they needed to transform themselves in order to be a real positive influence in the social life, and maybe we're beginning to turn the corner where we're beginning to realize that civic engagement is a necessary part of our spiritual practice. So there's a involvement in social and political and cultural issues that needs to move ahead. Now, I've invested most of my work in moving forward the integral worldview and helping people enter into a stream of practice that is clear and integral and robust and not only bound to any particular tradition or school, so that there's something in the public domain that nobody owns that describes the inherent and universal principles of practice that we can all find in common. And it's been my experience that a lot of folks involved with evolutionary spirituality recognize the importance of ILP and see ILP as a valid description of what they're involved with. The collective practices are very exciting when you've got a committed group of people who can enter into intersubjective space together and emerge into a collective awareness in which the wisdom that emerges in that space is higher than the wisdom of any individual, in which people's openness and suspension of their own perspective and their receptivity to one another and their ability to tune into what wants to emerge, as if the future is finding its way into the present through the collective consciousness of the group, that's pretty cool stuff. And many people are finding ways to facilitate that. That's part of what I do in the seminars and group teaching work that I'm involved with, and it's something that I think is being rapidly advanced by many people, sometimes even, you know, corporate consultants, and there are many different forms for tapping into that collective consciousness. It's becoming even more important because, you know, our world is in crisis, and the ways that we can, you know, most of us feel some sense of impotence and frustration wanting to make a bigger difference and to make a contribution that matters in terms of the big issues that face our world and the speed at which some of these critical problems are reaching a point of boiling over. How can we make a difference? Well, finding yourself in an agreement with a group where an awareness arrives in you as you that is shared with others, where you feel a sense of obligation and connection to a consensus that's bigger than yourself, those are very, very powerful potentials. So collective practice is, it's hard to engage, to find ways to engage that you can maintain over time. I think we're in the early stages of prototyping a new set of practices that are just emergent in our time. And I'm excited by the contributions that Andrew and the Evolutionary Enlightenment practitioners are engaging. I think it's a part of the vital cutting edge.
Thanks, Terry, and thanks, Neil, for your question.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Appreciate it. So I'm going to take another one from Instant Message. This is from Julia in Wisconsin. She says, this is really helpful territory to cover. How do you discern the difference between an individual or group practice that has, quote, run out of juice and what could be called the resistance of inertia? There are plateaus that seem to point in new directions, and then those that demand a deepening, a commitment to a practice. Are there telltale signs to notice as practice evolves?
Generally, almost, here's the paradox. When you practice on your own, you get into your own stucknesses, which you can break up by joining together with other people. But almost every school I've ever seen has found its way into its own forms of stuckness. And then individuals have the experience of being held back by their collective. And the, you know, ashrams and sanghas all over the West have, particularly in the traditions, you know, these traditions have been tested and vetted, and then they have forms that work to a certain degree, but they only work to a certain degree, and they tend to have their own forms of calcification. So I think that almost any traditional gathering of practitioners will have some limits on its juice. Even the most vital and vibrant ones have, I'd say the most vital ones, the ones really on the extreme, maybe aren't so fixed, but they have a lot of casualties. And then those that have established enough rules of the road that they're reasonably compassionately accounting for the human beings involved have substituted forms that tend towards stuckness. So there's no perfect place to practice. There is no environment that is going to support you and only support you. This is the real tricky thing about post-postmodern practice, is the fact that you have to take a meta perspective even on the forms and the communities in which you practice. And most of us can't do that. Most of us find ourselves needing to simply surrender, simply go into a belief mode in order to feel enough congruence, in order to be relieved of our cognitive dissonance enough to just wholeheartedly go for it. But what it takes to wholeheartedly go for it and notice the foibles and stucknesses in the context in which we're working, that's the new level of capacity that's being asked for in our time from most practitioners. It's one of the things that I often find myself coaching people with is their knowledge that they don't have a better context for practice than the one they're in, but their feeling of incomplete congruence with aspects of the context they're dealing with. And finding ways to meet those gaps with compassion and generosity and forgiveness and not become bound by the limits, but not necessarily to have to separate yourself out even when encountering them. That's one of the really juicy cutting edges that I see.
I just want to jump in. It really strikes me here because the conversation we were having earlier about, you know, the ego's safe position when it doesn't have any authority to submit itself to, and yet, you know, because you're kind of saying, well, how do you submit yourself to something while at the same time maintaining a meta perspective on it? And that, I mean, that really is a, wouldn't you say that the person who can effectively do that is already at a pretty high level of development? You know,
that's right.
Maybe to a level of development they don't really need. Don't really need the help. I mean, that's pretty sophisticated. You're bringing out.
That's right. The person who's gotten to that level is very, very profound. But there are little ways in which we can do little pieces of that even before we're stabilized in it. And it's beginning to discover the possibility of rising to that level of relationship to things that is often the cutting edge with some of the more advanced people that work with me. Yeah, it's part of the territory I find myself working in often.
Fascinating. That's great. Well, thanks for your question, Julia. So let's try another one. This is an instant message from Sharon in Denver. She says, if all wisdom is within, if the inner teacher is within, which I believe, why can't we just follow that and so not need an outer teacher? Pretty common question a lot of people have these days.
Yeah, well, you know, as long as your intuition is clear that the teacher is within and that you don't feel a draw toward an outer teacher, I have no argument with that. You can grow a lot just based on those presumptions. But the inner teacher is filtered through you. And all the distortions and subtle forms of egoity, the patterns and habits and comfort zones that tend to keep you in a certain range, are all filtering that inner teacher. So your blind spots are not necessarily permeable. It tends to be over time that people who are oriented toward simply following the inner teacher tend to grow only to a certain degree. There's a breakthrough to another level of awakeness that can become possible when you're instructed in ways that help you break beyond what you can see from where you stand. Now, you can do that in gentler ways than necessarily surrendering completely to a guru. This is one of the values of the coaching model in which I'm working, in which people can have insights that take them beyond what they can see themselves so that inner guru can shine with fewer obstructions and be heard, and the ways that you would tend to practice and the perimeter of the territory that you would tend to inhabit can still be expanded. But this is something you have to have a sense for. As long as you're following the inner teacher and your sense is that you're hearing that signal in a clear way and that you trust that, I have no interest to challenge you in that. If you have the awareness of this larger field, like we've just now been, you know, talking about, you may find yourself curious about what lies outside the perimeter of what you can access. And when that happens, you might choose to work with a teacher. But that's your call. It's not useful at this time or in this context for me to challenge you there, and I don't.
Great. Thanks for your question, Sharon. And we got one more by instant message from Encinitas. This is from Dorothy. She says, at this point in my understanding, I feel that enlightenment happens suddenly without thought, intention, or will, and that we cannot know ahead of time just what the triggers will be for that paradigm shift. Given these assumptions, how might I integrate this into your system of awakening, or are they mutually exclusive?
Well, no, they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. There's some interesting paradoxes there. In a way, awakening is spontaneous, and it only comes, you know, in its own sweet time, in its own moment. It's a happy accident. This reminds me of a story that Ken Wilber used to like to tell about Baker Roshi, that enlightenment is a happy accident, but the more I meditate, the more accident-prone I become. Your practice doesn't cause awakening, but practice is what we do when we're more awakened. We don't have to do it as a form of seeking. We can do it really as a form of stewardship of the body-mind and stewardship of the gift of life, that when we're enlivened by eating a certain diet, we eat that diet more. We make that choice spontaneously. And somebody who's healthier, a body-mind that is freer, less stiff, more flexible, is just better able to conduct the force of reality and be the antenna that lightning of enlightenment can strike.
Fantastic answer. Thanks. Okay, we're gonna do one more here. Let's try and take John Thompson from Orlando, Florida. John, you're on the line.
Yes,
hey,
I was wondering. It's not him. It's me. It's his wife, Kim.
Hi, Kim.
was wondering if the teacher and student relationship was one that has to happen with the student on an individual level before it happens with the student teacher on a collective level, and then extending outward to other people, or if it can happen on an individual level first and then be expounded on by the teacher, or if other people outside really have a huge effect just by revealing what we see inside of ourselves.
I'm not sure I completely understand the first part of your question. Are you saying that do you need some kind of an initiation from the awakened transmission of the teacher in order to make the path possible? Was that what you meant to ask?
Correct. Can you really be conduit with the egoic things that get in the way to be in a group relationship, or does it have to happen first on an individual, personal level with the teacher?
You know, there are people who would say it absolutely had to happen for me, that I was initiated by the awakened influence of my teacher. But it is the experience of other people that an awakening influence just naturally entered the stream of their awareness without their ever having a relationship to a teacher. And people have progressed pretty far along the way without that. So these kind of metaphysical claims that it always has to be one way, those claims rub me the wrong way. I think that there are many different ways the path unfolds. But having a respect for the fact that it might be, you know, that it might be necessary in someone's case, that the powerful liberating initiatory force of the transmission of an awakened being can be earth-shaking, shocking, amazing, remarkable, and let's not sell that short. But if your own intuition is telling you that you are on the right path, paying attention to the inner teacher, listening to the feedback of your friends and family and members of your Sangha, just growing in relationship to all kinds of different feedback that's outside yourself but not necessarily from a teacher, we don't need to challenge that. In some ways, Dharma and the path are evolving right now. If we have too rigid a set of prescriptions, we may find ourselves cutting off some of the new emergence that are really important to the emergence of Dharma in our time. So I'm...
Are you finding that it's gone from rigid and solid to more fluid within the changing aspects of where people are going to and where some of them are even at already, that it's becoming more fluid and that it can flow easier and quicker? Or are you finding that they still need that help from a teacher?
It is becoming more fluid. A lot of new possibilities are arising. And yet in that fluidity, there is a certain amount of chaos and a certain amount of room for self-delusion. Mm-hmm. So the fluidity is both functioning in positive and negative ways. And generalizing too confidently about all of this is probably a way to misunderstand what's before us. The heart really needs to be uncompromisingly yoked to an intuition of radical, radical freedom and love and service and awakeness, a sense of a possibility for a human life that really transcends the ordinary. And if that's not arising spontaneously, if there's a possibility beyond what you're experiencing that you sense is there, then a willingness to go beyond the scope of what you already know is appropriate. But we are in a time in which the old forms are breaking down. You know, this discrediting of the old of the gurus is only one part of it. Another thing that's happening is that we're becoming it's like a consumer-centered marketplace in which all the churches and teachers and sanghas are trying to serve the needs of the individual aspirants, and the aspirant becomes king. Well, that means the ego becomes king, unless, you know, except in the case of the most discriminating and gifted aspirant. So these generalizations are these are really good questions that you're asking, and it would be I think the fact that we're sitting with the question is really healthy. But if I were to answer the question confidently, as if there is one way that it is, we'd close mm-hmm. things off in a way that would be unhealthy.
So it's letting go of the need to have that question answered that I should really seek for.
I think that if you sit in the intelligence that gives birth to that question and are really tenderly in touch with your heart's highest aspirations, you're going to be able to be in touch with your best intuition and respond to the challenges and possibilities in your life most best. And to always stay open to learning something new. You know, we can tend to close things off, make a choice, and then imagine that we've left the point of choice, but there's a new choice every step along the way. So it's an action inquiry. Each time you act, you're conducting an experiment. You're trying on for size what it's like to live from the choice you just made. And now something new will be revealed. Now there's another transmission of information that's going to arrive.
Thank you. Thanks, Terry. And Kim, thanks so much for your question. Really appreciate it. So Terry, we're at the end, but I'm wondering if before we wrap up, if you could tell us a little bit about what you're working on currently, what's your latest venture, and also if somebody wants to get in touch with you, either for coaching or to learn more about your programs, what do you have coming up? What's interesting?
Yeah, thank you, Craig. Well, my website is integralheart.com, and that lists information about the Integral Life Practice book, which I certainly recommend, information about coaching with me, mention some of the upcoming events. I'll be doing some, in November there'll be a day-long in Sacramento, in January in New York City. This spring I'll be doing a 2 or 3 day thing at Brighton Bush Hot Springs. And they're doing some teaching in France this October at something called Renaissance 2, which is a network of evolutionary leaders from around the world that'll include some of your past guests, Don Beck and Andrew Cohen and Barbara Marx Hubbard and Neil Donald Walsh and a variety of people trying to get together, and that's Renaissance 2 at Perpignan, France. The thing that you mentioned at the beginning, though, is actually even more immediate, which is Bay Area Integral. People who are interested to know about Bay Area Integral, if you sign up for my send a contact form, just a website feedback form from Integral Heart. Let me know you're interested in Bay Area Integral, and make sure to add you to the list. And if you're interested to volunteer and help us expand that community, that's something I'm working on now too.
Me too. So we're going to be doing some great things locally, and for anyone in the Bay Area, let's come together and see what we can create. Great. Okay, Terry, well, thanks so much. So, again, it's integralheart.com if you want to find out what Terry's up to and track his teachings around the world, et cetera. So, Terry, this has been a real pleasure and an education, as always. I love speaking with you, and I just thought you brought a lot of illumination to many fronts. So I'm sure I speak for everyone when I say thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Craig.
All right. Take care.
It was a pleasure. You're always so much fun to talk with.
Great. Well, thank you. So before I tell you about what's coming up next, just a few reminders. If you're interested in diving deeper into the conversation, be sure and join our Facebook group where you can participate in discussion forums on any of the topics we discussed today. You can go to facebook.com and search for Great Integral Awakening Group, or just click on the link in the email we sent you this morning. You can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/integralspirit. And if you want to learn more about my work, visit integralenlightenment.com. If you have any friends you think might be interested in this series, please feel free to forward them one of our emails so they can join us. And if someone sent you this audio or you found it somewhere on the Internet and you'd like to listen to the other 14 dialogues in this series, visit greatintegralawakening.com. That's greatintegralawakening.com. And finally, I want to thank all the sponsors who've made all this possible, including Now and Zen, makers of the Zen Alarm Clock, iEvolve Global Practice Community, The Shift Movie, The New Feminine Power, Ursa Minor Arts and Media, Enlighten Next, Next Step Integral, and Big Mind, and of course our two co-hosts, Integral Life and Integral Enlightenment. Now, next week at the same time, we're going to have Claire Zammit, who you know by now as the person, woman, who's been introducing each of these events. And she, what you may not know is that she is also a brilliant teacher in her own right. She's going to be speaking about Women on the Edge of Evolution, the Sacred Task of Midwifing the Integral Feminine. And she's a co-creator of the New Feminine Power courses and workshops, and she co-leads a thriving community of thousands of women throughout the world who are all interested in this integral evolutionary perspective and how to be all they can be and make a contribution to the world, everything Terry was talking about today. So I would invite you to join us here next week for that. We'll send you an event description and access codes for that event this week. And until then, thanks for joining us, and keep evolving. Have a great week.